content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we'll be reading from the Week edition, dated November 18th, 2011. We'll begin with the main story section, Iran's Pursuit of Nuclear Weapons. What happened? The world was faced with this week with the prospect of a nuclear-armed Iran as the United Nations report concluded that the Islamic Republic has secretly been working on bomb technology and will soon have the capability to build warheads. In a 25-page report based on satellite photos, inspections, and more than 1,000 documents, the International Atomic Energy Agency detailed for the first time what it called credible evidence that Iran has gathered the material, technology, and skills required to manufacture nuclear weapons. Not only has Iran continued to enrich uranium despite international sanctions, said the IAEA, but it has also conducted computer modeling of nuclear explosions and warheads and developed triggering devices. The report said Iran might already have enough nuclear material to build 4 bombs. Tehran dismissed the report as U.S.-inspired propaganda. The Iranian nation is wise, said Iranian President Mohammad Ahmadinejad. It won't build 2 bombs against 20,000 nuclear bombs that you already have. In response, the U.S. signaled it would seek more severe international economic sanctions on Iran. Reports from Israel suggested that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu believes an Iranian bomb would pose an existential threat to his country's survival and was seeking political support to launch airstrikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. But Defense Minister Ehud Barak said that the Israeli government would be content with coordinated international lethal sanctions on Iran. We don't want a war, he said. What the editorial said. Tehran's big secret is finally out in the open, said the Washington Times. But these revelations should come as no surprise. The warning signs have been apparent for almost a decade, yet we in the West dither, said Investors Business Daily. Our pathetic economic sanctions have done nothing to dissuade this Islamist version of the Third Reich from building nukes, but targeted bombing strikes are apparently off the table. Why sit idly as a terrorist nuclear storm gathers? Because aerial strikes on Iran would be a nightmare, said the London Guardian. The Iranians would immediately shut the Strait of Hormuz, strangling 40% of the world's oil supply, and plunging the West into economic crisis. Ground troops would be needed to reopen it as missiles rain down on Israel from Lebanon and Gaza. Make no mistake, this would be war. Now here's what the columnist said. Whatever the consequences of the preemptive military strike, said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal, the alternative is surely worse. Under the security of a nuclear umbrella, Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei would seek domination of the region and perhaps an opportunistic war with Israel. An Iranian bomb would also trigger a nuclear arms race in the world's most unstable region, as Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Egypt all scrambled to catch up. A short, concentrated aerial and naval bombardment of Iran's nuclear facilities by U.S. forces is the only option, said Benny Avni in the New York Post. It could hasten a rebellion against the mullahs, stop the nuclear program in its tracks, and change the course of Mideast and world history. Attacking Iran would come at a terrible cost, said David Remnick in NewYorker.com. It would surely lead to a bloody regional war and leave Israel under attack and more deeply isolated than ever before. The U.S. and Israel would do far better to pursue a course of rigorous containment, intensifying sanctions, building greater U.S. alliances with Arab states, and dampening Israeli tensions with the Palestinians. Containing the Iranian threat would be complicated and costly, but surely it's preferable to all-out war. In truth, there are no good options here, said Jeffrey Goldberg in TheAtlantic.com. Military strikes on Iran would be disastrous, but learning to live with an Iranian bomb would be a huge defeat for the U.S. and unacceptable to Israel. Obama's only choice may be to intensify the various subterfuge programs currently operating against Iran, waging cyber warfare with Stuxnet 2.0 virus, for example, and persuading the mullahs that he's serious about using military force. If the Iranians believe the threat of a U.S.-Israeli military attack is real, they might still be persuaded to back away from the brink. The next item from the main story section of the Week magazine, Europe's debt crisis topples two governments. What happened? Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi and Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou were forced to announce their resignations this week as European leaders struggled to contain the Eurozone's accelerating debt crisis. The focus of concern has shifted from Greece to far larger Italy, the European Union's second most indebted country, where an embattled Berlusconi finally pledged to step down after failing to secure a parliamentary majority on a key budget vote. But the prospect of his departure failed to calm market fears that Italy will soon be unable to pay its debts. Government bond rates soared past 7%, the level at which Greece, Ireland, and Portugal requested bailouts. With $2.6 trillion in total government debt, Italy is seen as simply too big for the EU to bail out. Berlusconi cast his exit, which he said would come as soon as austerity measures are passed, as a way to restore markets' faith in the country, but it hasn't done so yet. We have to show markets that we're serious, Berlusconi said. Greek leader Papandreou stepped down following a dramatic week in Athens in which he retracted his pledge to hold a referendum on the Greek bailout. Though he survived a confidence vote in Parliament, members of his own party subsequently abandoned him. Amid bitter inter-party squabbling, members of Parliament were still negotiating to name a new leader and form an interim Greek government, which would rule until elections in February. Now here's what the editorial said. Good riddance, Silvio, said Bloomberg.com. Berlusconi's dazzling unfitness for the office has been made plain by charges that he mingled his government and business interests and hired prostitutes for wild parties. His serial scandals, prosecutions, and diplomatic pratfalls have helped push Italy to the point of financial breakdown. A default by the Italian government would be the heaviest blow yet to strike the world economy, but competent leadership can still save the country from that fate. Don't be so sure, said the London Telegraph. An end to Bunga Bunga may give Italy back a little of her pride, but it solves nothing. Berlusconi's successor is unlikely to deliver economic reforms or enliven an Italian economy that has been stagnant for over a decade. The bottom line is that Italy is in the wrong currency, condemned to economic woes so long as it holds on to the euro. Is Washington watching? Said the Chicago Tribune. As goes Europe, so goes America. The U.S. economy will continue to suffer as long as this debt mess persists. But as the crisis decapitates national governments in European capitals, it also offers U.S. politicians an uncomfortable preview of what could be in store for them if they fail to rein in our own national debt. Washington should consider Europe's troubles a warning. Now here's what the columnist said. Even in Italy, it's the economy, stupid, said Stephen Ferris in Time.com. There's a certain poetry to Berlusconi's being brought down, not by his many sex and corruption scandals, but by the country's finances. For years, his gaffes and failure to deliver reforms were merely occasions for amusement. Now, they're actual liabilities. But the pressure on Berlusconi to resign didn't come from Italian voters fed up with his idiocies, said Harold Meyerson in the Washington Post. It came from the bond markets, which are making it impossible for Italy to finance its debt. Berlusconi was an autocratic narcissist and no poster boy for democracy. But at the end of the day, this is a case of the markets triumphing over Italy's sovereignty. National sovereignty is yet another victim in a misguided quest to save the euro at all costs, said Gideon Rockman in the Financial Times. The common currency was designed to promote economic prosperity and political harmony, but clearly it is doing the precise opposite. So perhaps it's time to get real about ditching it. Beyond Greece and Italy, Spain, Ireland, and Portugal are all still teetering on the edge and could tumble over with the next inevitable crisis. Breaking with the euro will be painful and difficult, but Europe's leaders need to start planning for it. Now from The Week magazine, we'll turn to the controversy of the week. 2012, could Obama win despite everything? The next presidential election is exactly a year away, said Nate Silver in the New York Times, and for all the disarray in the Republican field, it just might not be a winnable one for President Obama. Polls now indicate that while most Americans understand that Obama inherited a terrible predicament, they're beginning to doubt he's up to the job of reviving the economy. He now heads into election year saddled with a higher unemployment rate, 9%, and a lower approval rating, 45%, than any president since the one-term Jimmy Carter. A lot depends on whether Republicans nominate a candidate palatable to centrist voters and whether the economy is improving next fall. If economic growth picks up, I project Obama would have an 83% chance of beating Rick Perry and a 60% chance of beating Mitt Romney. But if the recovery continues to sputter, the president's odds against Perry fall to 41% and a daunting 17% against Romney. The bottom line, Obama is a slight underdog to win re-election. The president clearly faces a toxic political environment, said Chris Chiliza in the Washington Post, but the numerical landscape of the Electoral College gives him several paths to victory. Obama needs 270 electoral votes to win re-election. In 2008, he got 365, partly by winning three states, Indiana, North Carolina, and Virginia, that are usually red, and sweeping six other swing states, Colorado, Florida, Iowa, Nevada, New Mexico, and Ohio. Assuming all the blue states remain in the Democratic column, Obama needs to win only two or three of the nine critical swing states he won in 2008, taking just 23 electoral votes from the 112 available to regain the White House. The economy does matter a lot, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times, but voters know the economic crisis began under President Bush. If the modest recovery continues, independents may be reluctant to change horses midstream. For those reasons, says political scientist Larry Bartels of Vanderbilt University, Obama is very likely to win even if economic conditions do not improve. I wouldn't bet on that, said Adam Yoshida in AmericanThinker.com. Like the failed presidents Herbert Hoover and Jimmy Carter before him, Obama was elected amidst tremendous hope that he could personally solve the nation's problems and then flopped. Like Hoover and Carter, Obama is cursed with a difficult and intellectual personality that has kept him from genuinely engaging with the American people. Voters see him as the failed social engineer who force-fed the country Obamacare and $860 billion in ineffective stimulus. The arc of history clearly points toward defeat. Obama does have a secret weapon, said Michael Tomosky in the DailyBeast.com. It's the Republican Party. The partisan sabotage and stubborn intransigence of GOP congressional leaders have turned off most voters. A new Suffolk University poll found that 59% of crucial moderate voters believe that Republicans have been intentionally stalling efforts to jumpstart the economy. In another poll, 57% of all voters view the GOP unfavorably. If Obama can hammer home the message that Republicans have blocked efforts to create jobs and can't be trusted with more power, he'll eke out a victory. Republicans are poisoning their brand with their extremism, said Steve Kornacki in Salon.com, and this may be Obama's best hope for salvation. Even if voters are ambivalent about Obama, they will think twice before handing the White House to anyone with an R next to his name. And now from the Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the very popular column, The Good Week For and The Bad Week For, always entertaining. It was a good week for calling off the wedding after a South African couple who dated for 5 years found out they were brother and sister who'd been separated in childhood. The truth emerged when the couple's families gathered to discuss wedding plans. It was a good week for instant karma after Victor Giesbrecht, 61, stopped on a Wisconsin highway to help a stranger, Sarah Berg, change a tire. After he drove off, Giesbrecht suffered a heart attack. Berg then stopped her car and saved his life by performing CPR. And it was a good week for appeasing an apparently angry deity. After the House of Representatives took time out from its work on the budget deficits, soaring unemployment, and other pressing problems to reaffirm, by a vote of 396-9, that the national motto is, In God We Trust. It was a bad week for the war on Christmas after Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker declared that the tree set up in the Capitol Rotunda this December will be known as a Christmas tree instead of a holiday tree. It was a bad week for the NBA after only 12% of people polled said they missed pro basketball now that the start of the season has been canceled because of a contract impasse between players and owners. And it was a bad week for whining after convicted pedophile Eric Harris sued the Florida prison system for serving meals that are 50% soy protein. Harris says that the soy is giving him stomach cramps and that depriving him of beef and pork during his life sentence constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. And now we'll turn to the People's section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled Rourke's Decade of Obscurity. Mickey Rourke is grateful for second chances, said Kevin Williamson in the Toronto Sun. After a rapid climb to stardom in the 1980s, Rourke blew up his career with years of drinking, angry outbursts, and erratic behavior, including a stint as a professional boxer that left his good looks ruined. He spent much of the 90s waiting for the phone to ring. After 7 years go by, you think, wow, I really screwed up, says the actor, 59. But then 10 years go by, and you think they're not going to let you in the door again, he says. I really thought I could turn it around in a year or two, but it just didn't happen. I remember going to Sunset Boulevard and buying a pack of cigarettes, and some fat guy goes by and says, Hey, didn't you used to be? And he mentioned the wrong name. Rourke started seeing a psychologist 15 years ago and credits therapy with helping him put his life and career back together. But he still doesn't quite trust himself. I'm very capable of having that happen again. If I could screw up tomorrow easily or in the next 10 minutes... I think it's like a guy who gets out of jail. I just had to change. The next item, the woman who took on Bank of America. Molly Catchpole took on the big bank and won, said Ian Shapira in the Washington Post. In October, the 22-year-old recent college graduate's ire was raised when she read about Bank of America's plan to start charging customers $5 a month to use their debit cards. A Bank of America customer, she went online to a do-it-yourself petition site and began typing her frustrations. When the recession first hit, we gave Bank of America billions of dollars in bailout money, Catchpole wrote. Our reward is higher fees for the same services. At some point, we've got to say, enough is enough. She posted the gripe, and within a month, 300,000 people had signed her petition. Last week, the bank backed off, largely in response to Catchpole's petition. She was just doing what she's always done. She grew up writing letters to her local newspaper. She once complained about a state senator's proposal to make the driver's license test English only. I wrote the paper saying we had bigger things to worry about, she says. For now, she's worried about paying her bills. She has struggled to find full-time work. But things may be changing. She's been getting emails from nonprofits. People keep asking me what I am going to do next. I don't know. I'm not much of a policy wonk, but I am absolutely an activist at heart. And the next item from the People section, Winslet's latest divorce. Kate Winslet has been unlucky in love, said Justine Picardi in Harper's Bazaar, UK. The actress lost her first love, Stephen Treader, to bone cancer in 1997. Her first marriage ended in divorce in 2001. Last year brought the end of her second marriage to director Sam Mendes, whom she wed in 2003. Though heartbroken over the divorce, she kept a tight lid on her feelings. I kept pushing it away, not even sharing it a huge amount with friends, she says. Because you know what it's like as soon as you open that can of worms, you wish you'd never taken the lid off. For a film, she can shed a tear on command, but expressing real emotions proved challenging to her. I've had to remind myself to have those moments of being able to have a good cry. But it did take someone putting their hand on me, a gay male friend, who put his hand on my shoulder and said, "It's okay. You can cry about this, and maybe you should." Acknowledging her grief has given her empathy for her ex. The thing that I am very grateful for, weirdly, is that I've been through it before, she says. However hard it's been for me, it's been equally hard for him. Now we'll turn to the briefing section of the week's magazine, and this week it's entitled 3D's Fading Promise. Films that create the illusion of depth perception were supposed to revolutionize the movie industry. What happened? When did Hollywood first use 3D? Well, it took off in the 1950s when the studios saw 3D features as a way to lure customers away from their new television sets. But most filmmakers treated the technology as a gimmick, and after a string of mediocre movies with titles like Catwoman of the Moon, 3D survived only in theme parks and the occasional animated feature. It was not until the 2009 release of James Cameron's Avatar, filmed using new high-definition 3D cameras, that 3D realized its potential in a mainstream film. The sci-fi epic quickly became the highest-grossing film of all time, with 85% of its revenue coming from 3D screenings. Major studio heads said the new technology and the hefty premium they could charge for it would reverse falling box office revenues. There have been three revolutionary movements in the film world, Jeffrey Katzenberg, chief executive of DreamWorks Animation, said in 2010, the introduction of sound, color, and now 3D. Did the enthusiasm last? No. Audiences have clearly become very ambivalent about 3D. This summer, for the first time, a majority of viewers chose to see a 3D picture, Pirates of the Caribbean 4, in the 2D format, thereby avoiding the higher price of 3D tickets. The same fate befell Kung Fu Panda 2, Green Lantern, and the final Harry Potter sequel, all of which were expected to reap huge profits from 3D screenings. And if 3D was supposed to get audiences back into the movie theaters, it didn't work. Cinema attendance dropped to a 17-year low this summer. Analysts are now predicting that the audience drop-off for 3D movies will only get worse, and investors are taking flight. RealD, which leases 3D equipment to movie theaters, saw its share price plummet 70% over the summer. U.S. consumers are increasingly rejecting 3D movies, said Wall Street analyst Richard Greenfield. What don't audiences like? The price, for one thing. Movie theaters charge a $4 to $5 premium for a 3D ticket, and many consumers no longer think it's worth the cost. That may be partly due to this year's glut of mediocre, poorly made 3D movies. Studios released 18 movies in format this summer, compared with 7 the previous summer. Many of them were hastily converted in post-production rather than being filmed using 3D cameras. And they ended up with poor effects that were too dark to see properly. It produces what I call 2.5D, said Cameron. Studies have found that as many as 30% of viewers become nauseous while watching movies in 3D format, which requires a viewer's eyes to focus on the screen while converging on the constantly changing distance of the 3D images. That unfamiliar visual experience, Northwestern University ophthalmology professor Michael Rosenberg said, translates into greater mental effort, making it easier to get a headache. What do directors think? Well, some influential Hollywood filmmakers think 3D is a technological stunt with no real value. Christopher Nolan, director of Inception, refused to make a Batman sequel in 3D. On an experiential level, I find the dimness of the image extremely alienating, he said. Walter Merck, the Oscar-winning editor of Apocalypse Now and The English Patient, rejects the technology as dark, small, stroby, headache-inducing, alienating, and expensive. But other directors are still intrigued with the possibilities of the format. Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, and Ridley Scott are all releasing 3D movies this winter, and Cameron's sequel to Avatar, due in 2014 and 2015, mean 3D movies will still generate a lot of cash. Will other 3D films be made? Probably. The format still makes money for the studios, even though fewer Americans went to the movies last summer. Domestic box office revenue was up by 1%, buoyed by the higher ticket prices for 3D movies. International audiences find the format exciting. Sales of 3D tickets rose in Japan, the UK, and Russia last year. There's also evidence that cinemagoers in the U.S. are still prepared to don 3D glasses for the right film. The recent 3D remake of The Lion King drew big audiences. Some industry experts believe 3D will become much more popular once the technology evolves to the point where glasses aren't necessary. That's estimated to be about a decade away. So what's the future of 3D? Well, it's likely to exist as a niche market rather than as the future of cinema. We're going to be selective in terms of where we deploy 3D, said Brad Gray, chief executive of Paramount Pictures. It needs to be with the right storyteller, the right project, and the right director. Hollywood is realizing that audiences won't pay a surcharge to see a mediocre movie with bad 3D. A number of people thought they could just deliver a kind of low-end, crappy version of 3D and people wouldn't care, said Katzenberg recently. Nothing could have been further from the truth. The one-time 3D evangelist said that if the studios deliver quality films, the format will return to favor. I think it will take us a while, but we'll earn it back. And the footnote to this briefing column about 3D is entitled 3D in Your Living Room. Hollywood was hardly alone in hoping to reap big profits from 3D technology. The television industry also leaped onto the bandwagon, launching expensive 3D TV sets to bring the technology into the nation's living rooms. It has flopped there even worse than it has in the movie theaters. Fewer than 3 million 3D TVs are likely to be sold this year, a fraction of the 18 million in annual sales predicted as recently as January. Viewers are reportedly turned off by the cost of the new sets, which can top $1,300, the paucity of quality 3D content, and the thought of having to wear special glasses to watch TV at home. A recent study found that more than half of consumers seeking a new TV said they wouldn't consider a 3D set. Cable magnate Mark Cuban, head of HDNet, is standing back too. 3D on TV is a bust, he said. And now we'll turn to the best columns of the week in the United States, according to The Week magazine. Our first one is entitled "The Pedophile Nobody Suspects" by Frank Bruni in the New York Times. Most pedophiles do not wear trench coats or lurk in parks, said Frank Bruni. They're more likely to be really nice guys who work as coaches, teachers, counselors, priests, or some other position where they have access to minors. Former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky, 67, is the latest widely respected do-gooder charged with molesting kids. Sandusky is accused of using his charity for troubled kids to gain a special position of trust and access to young boys. This is how it usually works. In most molestation cases, the predators have true affection for kids and seek a role as their champions. Their affinity for kids just happens to have a sexual element, the satisfaction of which they've convinced themselves isn't such a big harmful deal. Most adults who work with children are, of course, not pedophiles, but parents should be on alert for warning signs, such as adults who give kids gifts and treat them with a creepy attentiveness. As the abuse scandals involving the Catholic Church, the Boy Scouts, and now Penn State have shown, institutions do an awful job of policing themselves. The next column is entitled "Telling the Truth About the Deficit" by Robert J. Samuelson in the Washington Post. The U.S. will never succeed in closing its mammoth budget deficit, said Robert Samuelson, until Americans give up our fairy tales. Conservatives like to pretend that budgets can be balanced if we just cut wasteful spending, farm subsidies, Amtrak, community block grants, and subsidies to NPR and cultural organizations, and change the rules on Social Security and Medicare. But eliminating the discretionary programs conservatives hate would save less than $100 billion when total spending last year was $3.5 trillion. If new taxes are off the table, do conservatives really want to eliminate the national parks, the FBI, highways? The liberal solution, taxing the rich and cutting defense to the bone, is no less delusional. The top 10% already pay 55% of all federal taxes. Besides, adding a millionaire surtax or higher tax rates would not avert the need for major cuts and entitlement reform. If we are to be serious about the deficit, we'll have to accept both large, painful spending cuts and substantial tax increases. Any politician or partisan pundit who says differently is lying and postponing our nation's day of reckoning. And the next column is entitled "The Lesson from Kim's Divorce" by Jennifer Posner in the DailyBeast.com. Kim Kardashian has done American women a big favor, said Jennifer L. Posner. The reality TV star's farcical 72-day marriage has finally drawn back the veil on reality TV's fairy tale narratives and exposed them as the hollow and manipulative shams that they are. Despite their name, reality shows have little to do with real life or real people and send destructive messages to the millions of young women who watch them avidly. In shows such as The Bachelor and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, Women live in Darwinian competition with one another for rich, arrogant men, and the winners are skinny, bitchy, desperate, and vapid. Relationships are shallow and have but one goal, a ludicrously expensive wedding. It's tempting to laugh all this off as harmless fluff, but it's not. The growing luxury wedding market, now pulling in $80 billion a year, feeds on these fantasies. Maybe as viewers watch the reruns of Kim's fairy tale wedding and watch Kim promising to love her betrothed forever, they'll realize that reality TV is one big regressive fantasy. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for November 18th, 2011. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we're going to flip to the back of the magazine to the column entitled The Last Word. This week it's entitled Seized by Pirates. After Somalis boarded the Chandler sailboat, says Jeffrey Gettleman, the couple spent a year waiting to die. It wasn't really a pretty night, Rachel Chandler recalled. Small waves were coming from the southeast, and a trickle of wind blew from the southwest. There was no moon, and the stars were shrouded by clouds. The boat was heading from the Seychelles archipelago to Tanzania, a two-week passage across the Indian Ocean. The wind was pushing them farther north than they'd planned, with no ships or land in sight. The Chandler's 38-foot sailboat, the Lynn Rival, bobbed along all alone. Rachel, who is 57, was on watch, and her husband Paul, 61, was asleep now below deck. It was about 2:30 a.m. Because the wind was so faint, Rachel turned on the sailboat's small engine, which was just loud enough to drown out other noise. By the time she heard the high-pitched whine of outboard motors, she had only seconds to react. Two skiffs suddenly materialized, and when she swung the flashlight's beams onto the water, two gunshots rang out. "No guns! No guns!" she screamed. The crack of assault rifles jarred Paul awake. Within seconds, eight scruffy Somali men hoisted themselves aboard their rifles and rocket-propelled grenade launchers, clanging against the hull. The men stank of the sea and nervous musk, and they jabbed their guns at the Chandlers. "Stop engine," they shouted. "Crew, crew, how many crew number?" Then they demanded a shower. This was October 23rd, 2009. The Chandlers would be held for the next 388 days. In the past few years, gangs of Somali pirates, kitted out with fiberglass skiffs, rusty Kalashnikovs and flip-flops, have waylaid hundreds of ships and extracted ransom for their return. More than 20 ships have been seized this year, and the average ransom is now upward of $5 million. Of all the thousands of people who have been held for ransom, though, few, if any, have endured as long an experience behind pirate lines as Paul and Rachel Chandler. The couple met in London in 1979. A few years after they married, they bought a share in the Lynn Rival. When they retired a few years ago, they began sailing full-time, exploring the Adriatic, the Red Sea, Egypt, India, Sudan, Oman, and Eritrea. They were fully aware that the Indian Ocean was a hunting ground for Somali pirates, but Paul, a Cambridge-trained engineer with a hyper-rational way of looking at the world, considered the risks of being hijacked to be very remote. "It was a fluke of the wind that put us where we were," he said. "We didn't know who these guys were," Mohammed Aden said of the pirates who took the Chandlers. "They were nobodies, people we call cockroaches, gangsters, new to the system. It was the first time they had brought anybody to land, the first time they had ever captured anybody. It took us 6 months to establish who they were." Aden is the president of the Hyman and Heeb administration, a small clan-based government in central Somalia. 2 decades of chaos have resulted in these tiny statelets popping up across the country. There are more than 20 formed by members of the same clan, the one fundamental element of Somali society that has not been totally eviscerated by civil war. Aidan works in Adado, a training town about 200 miles from the coast. He's a naturalized American and lived in the U.S. for years before being drafted by elders in his clan to build a government from scratch, complete with a functional police force, environmental laws, and schools. Technically, Hyman and Hebe's jurisdiction extends to the coast, but Aidan has no authority there. The area is controlled by pirate gangs. "I don't have the firepower to take these guys on," Aidan said. "I'd like to, but I can't." All anyone in Adado knew was that an upstart named Bugas had taken the Chandlers to a town called Amara, near the coast, and that locals were backing him up. Local support is crucial because holding hostages can become expensive. You need to keep them fed and, most important, heavily guarded, so a rival pirate gang or Islamist militia doesn't re-kidnap them. Paul figures it cost Bugas nearly $20,000 a month to hold him and Rachel hostage. For Rachel, the days blur together. They would read the few books they were allowed to grab from the yacht. Sometimes they did yoga. Once Paul turned around to see half a dozen gunmen earnestly following along. It seemed everyone was horribly bored. "I was struggling," Rachel told me. "I'd get through the early part of the morning, and then the heat and humidity would build up, and I'd be lying there thinking, I don't want to read, I don't want to do anything. How am I going to get through the next 10 minutes, let alone 10 hours, let alone 10 days? Bugas, for his part, was supremely confident that he was on the verge of making millions. "British government pay big money, no problem," he kept saying. He was constantly threatening them. "No money, you dead, kill you." The Chandler's total life savings was $500,000. The pirates scoffed at such petty cash and demanded $7 million. Paul suggested the pirates call Rachel's brother, Stephen, a retired farmer in England. Stephen still seems shaken up. "How would you feel if you got a phone call from a guy who says, 'I got your sister and her husband at gunpoint, so you better send us everything you got and more, and you'll be lucky if you get them back'?" The Chandlers soon deduced that escape or rescue was unlikely. The pirates operated with total impunity in their patch of Somalia. People were always coming by the camp, sitting for hours with the gang, making it abundantly clear that the whole community was complicit. For Paul, who is unfailingly polite and gentle, this is what brings out the bitterness. "Everyone was in on it," he said. "I'm angry at Somali society. I'm angry at the community." Bugas decided to separate the Chandlers to make them as miserable as possible, so they would urge their relatives to cough up the cash. The Chandlers refused and roped their arms around each other. "We didn't want to die alone," Rachel said. Bugas yanked out a tree root, stripped it smooth, and ferociously whipped the Chandlers. They crumpled to the ground, and the pirates pulled them apart. As gunmen dragged Paul away, he caught a glimpse of Rachel on her knees, screaming, "Bastards! Murderers!" Bugas smashed the back of his rifle into her jaw, shearing off a tooth. Thus began 3 long months of solitude. The Chandlers were held in huts a few miles apart and weren't allowed to communicate. Paul tried to keep himself occupied, sketching and making a phrase book of Somali words. There was one man, the cook, who occasionally spoke to him. At this point, Paul began his begging calls to relatives. While Rachel had qualms about leaning on family members, Paul said he saw the whole ordeal as a commercial transaction. "I would pay every penny I could scrimp, borrow, or steal to get me and Rachel out of here." But even accessing their savings was complicated. The Chandlers were officially under duress, the family solicitor informed Stephen, and therefore not considered mentally fit to hand over control of their accounts. Rachel, meanwhile, was completely isolated. Bugas instructed the guards not to talk to her. Rachel's cook would throw down a bowl of food and then just pad away. She started talking to herself and chanting. It tormented her to think that Bugas and his gang were going to profit from her misery. She had hidden a couple of razor blades in her hut and fantasized about slitting her wrists at night so the pirates would wake to find her sprawled in a pool of blood. But the problem was I wouldn't be able to see their faces, she ultimately realized. So what's the point of that? In late January, a doctor was allowed to see the Chandlers. Mohammed Dahir, a Somali journalist, tagged along and filmed the visit. Dahir was shocked at how bad Rachel looked. She was sitting up under a tarp in a bush camp, completely out of it, he said. She kept saying, I need my husband. I want to see my husband before I die. By the spring, after the Chandlers had spent 6 months in captivity, local opinion was turning against Bugas and his crew. People were making fun of the pirates, said Dahir. Everybody was saying they have this big debt and they're holding an old couple who don't have any money. Finally, it seemed to dawn on Bugas that he wasn't going to make much of a profit on this one. Stephen was negotiating a payment under $500,000, all the Chandler family could afford, but a fraction of what corporate ship owners typically pay. One pirate gang made $9.5 million last year by hijacking a Korean oil tanker. Bugas agreed to reunite the Chandlers while the arrangements were being finalized. Our hopes were sky high, Paul said, but then nothing happened. Dejected, they wondered whether Stephen got cold feet and backed out. When Mohammed Dahir returned in July, he whispered to the Chandlers that the money drop had been made. The pirates received nearly $450,000. What exactly happens next remains murky. Aiden and several others told me that a group of Somalis secretly collected several hundred thousand dollars to pay off the pirates. The Chandlers said they had the impression that a second payment was made. One day, Bugas came up to them and said something like, My Somali family give 200, referring to his clan. The pirates always spoke in thousands. On November 13, 2010, more than a year after they were taken, the Chandlers were told to pack their bags. They were finally free. When they arrived in London a few days later, they were energized by a surprising piece of news. The British Navy had recovered the Lynn Rival. She's now in a boatyard near Dartmouth, a quaint English town full of fudge shops, the opposite end of the universe from Somalia. The Chandlers insist they have had no lasting damage from the experience, physical or psychological, except, in Paul's words, we've spent 2% of our lives in Somalia. Shortly after they returned, the Chandlers agreed to a series of paid interviews with a London tabloid and a TV station, and then started working on a book, which was published in September in England. They did this with one goal in mind. They told me, make enough money to pay back their families and fix their boat, which still has a bullet hole in the boom. Profiting from their ordeal, Rachel says, is just a means to an end, and the end will be getting back on the Lynn Rival, though they are going to stay out of the Indian Ocean for the time being. That article was copyrighted in 2011 by the New York Times. And now we'll turn to the Talking Point section in the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled Herman Cain, The Accusations Mount. It's just getting worse for Herman Cain, said Roger Dreher in the AmericanConservative.com. The number of women accusing the surprise frontrunner in the Republican presidential race of sexual harassment keeps growing, and now those charges have a name and a face. This week, Sharon Bialik, 50, accused Cain of assaulting her during his tenure as head of the National Restaurant Association. Bialik claims that when she met with Cain about possible employment, he bought her drinks and dinner, then put his hand up her skirt and said, You want a job, right? Cain has heatedly denied Bialik's story, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com, insisting he doesn't remember knowing her and calling her story totally fabricated. His campaign, said Bialik, had declared bankruptcy twice, had a shaky employment history, and was now seeking financial gain. That might satisfy his diehard Tea Party supporters for now, but Cain's already slim chances of winning the nomination have been lowered considerably. Maybe so, says Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com, but it's worth noting that Cain's poll numbers have actually improved among GOP voters since harassment charges first began to surface. Cain's supporters are clinging to the idea that there's a conspiracy between establishment Republicans and the national news media to bring him down. Bialik herself is a conservative Republican, said Steve Kornacki in Salon.com, but the Cain campaign has sneeringly noted that her attorney is activist celebrity lawyer Gloria Allred, a much-despised figure on the right. Now that he's spinning Bialik's charges as the work of the Democratic machine, Cain just might continue defying gravity. We conservatives need to be consistent, said William Bennett in CNN.com. Those of us who insisted back in the 1990s that Bill Clinton's womanizing and lying were relevant to his job as president can't now give Cain a pass because he's a Republican. With at least four women making allegations, Cain can't argue any more that this is a witch hunt or a lynching. I fully understand the revulsion at the media frenzy over these charges, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. Still, I must admit being dismayed that some fellow conservatives are now saying that if Cain, a married man and minister, made a few passes at women, it's no big deal. It's liberals who excuse repugnant sexual behavior and Democratic politicians. We conservatives are supposed to be the folks who talk about how character matters. The next item, sexual harassment, a racket to extort money. Is sexual harassment just a ploy to extort money from innocent men, asked Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. Some of Herman Cain's conservative defenders are not merely saying they're taking his word against that of four accusers. They're insisting that sexual harassment no longer occurs and that the whole thing is just a racket. Right-wing ideologues like National Review's proud misogynist John Derbyshire have complained you pay a girl a compliment nowadays, she runs off and gets lawyered up, while former Senator Fred Thompson wrote that women can't wait to turn an innocent comment into their day in the limelight and the inevitable book deal. In the alternate reality of the right, men are the victims, while women who object to being groped, taunted, or pressured for sex are money-grubbing, hysterical, attention-seeking tramps. Perhaps that's an exaggeration, said Kurt Schlitter in the New York Post, but so is the notion that the modern office is filled with predatory lechers. In recent decades, the definition of sexual harassment has devolved from common sense into a farce, and men must now fear saying or doing anything a coworker might find offensive. The resulting grim puritanism has drained humor and humanity from the workplace. If you're accused of harassment today, said Kurt Levy in the Wall Street Journal, you're guilty until proven innocent. That's why companies often choose to settle any and all claims, however meritless. They know juries sometimes award millions in damages to women who allege harassment, and that even when companies or men win in court, they can ring up a legal bill of $100,000 or more. Occupy movement, time to go home. Occupy Wall Street is overstaying its welcome, said Jeff Cox in CNBC.com. Now almost 2 months old, the movement has begun to spawn credibility-damaging incidents in cities across the country. Accusations of sexual assault in New York and Cleveland, and unexplained death in Oklahoma City, and violent clashes between police and protesters in Oakland, California. As violent incidents mount and residents and businesses in various downtowns complain about public urination, filth, and noise, OWS is losing the support of the 99% it claims to represent. Only 30% of Americans now support the protests, according to a recent Quinnipiac poll. The movement had better control its extreme elements, said Joel Connolly in SeattlePI.com. OWS is successfully awoken a middle America to the real issue of wealth disparity and Wall Street greed. It would be a shame if that message were undermined by a small, noisy minority of anarchists, show-offs, and just people who are mad at the world. This violence isn't merely the work of a few bad apples, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Incoherent from its start, the movement is now being driven by a vanguard of self-proclaimed socialists and anarchists who reject capitalism outright and are acting like British soccer thugs in an attempt to overturn the system. Protesters in Oakland set fire to stores, threw concrete blocks at cops, and even declared a general strike to stop the flow of capital at the city port. It's time for the cops to break up the party, said NationalReview.com in an editorial, and they should start with the living, breathing blight at Zuccotti Park near Wall Street. Sure, the occupiers have a right to peaceably protest, but during the day, not in tent cities, set up in violation of law and common decency. The protesters must go home. And, as you know, if you've been listening to the news in the last 24 hours, they're starting to do just that in New York and some of the other cities. And we'll have more of an update, I'm sure, in next week's edition of The Week magazine. And let's take a look at a few short items here as we conclude our program for this week. Wall Street securities firms made $83 billion in profit during the first 2.5 years of the Obama administration, more than the $77 billion in profit these firms made over the entire 8 years of the George W. Bush presidency. In any 2 days, human beings create as much information online as it took our species to create in the 30,000 years between the dawn of cave painting and the year 2003. In another 10 years, that same amount of information will be generated in less than 1 hour. In response to an online petition signed by more than 12,000 people, the White House has formally denied any knowledge of extraterrestrial life. The petitioners asked the government admit that it's had contact with aliens, but the Obama administration responded that the government has no credible evidence. UFOs have visited Earth or that life exists outside our planet. In the course of the 2010-2011 school year, 48% of students in grades 7 through 12 experienced some form of sexual harassment, in person or through texting and social media, according to a new survey. It's now routine. Students say to be called whore or gay in rumors that spread like wildfire, to be sent unwanted sexual photos, or to be groped at school. All of things are common occurrences, according to the survey. And now, finally for this program, let's take a look at the poll watch that we check every week in The Week magazine. 76% of Americans say the nation's economic structure favors the rich and would support reducing the power of corporations and ending tax breaks for the affluent. At the same time, 53% say that the national debt and the size of government must be cut significantly and that taxes shouldn't be raised on anybody. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleRadioReadingService.org. So long until next time.